Hello, I'm Lindsay Charlton. Welcome to Narco Warriors. It's worth more than $1 trillion a year. It costs tens of thousands of lives. Governments have spent billions trying to fight it, and it corrupts individuals and states. It's the illegal drugs trade. For more than 50 years, a secret campaign has been fought across jungles, oceans, and cities against smugglers and cartels. It's now become a war in the Caribbean, as President Trump declares the traffickers are narco-terrorists. How did we get here? What's the real story of the secret war against the smugglers? We've gained unrivaled access to law enforcement professionals who have fought the drug war across the world. In this opening episode, we'll get a first-hand account of what's happening in Venezuela from our man in Caracas.
If you keep on killing them on the high seas, you don't get any intelligence.
And what do US police officers think about the Trump strategy? A former FBI agent gives us a view from the inside.
Some of my colleagues that feel that this is awful, wrong, and it should be stopped. There are others that say it's about time.
At the heart of this story are the investigators from Her Majesty's Customs and Excise. They operated with agencies across the world to disrupt the drugs trade and put the smugglers behind bars. Drug busts in the Atlantic, gunfights on beaches, mafia assassins and cartel stashes, informants, special forces for secret missions, kidnappings and murder. Just some of the stories we'll be telling over the coming weeks on Narco Warriors. Coming up, are drug traffickers criminals or terrorists? And do the rules of war apply?
Don't take out innocent people, whatever the circumstances. That is not acceptable.
How much are US missile strikes on drug runners really damaging supply lines?
They'll find new ways. They'll find new routes. They always do.
And the baptism of fire on a tropical beach.
I hear a shot fire out, and then all hell let loose.
Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories. These are the Narco Warriors. Welcome to Narco Warriors. First of all, I want to talk about some of the guests we're going to have in the future before I get to talk to our guests in the studio today. Alberto Morales, who is the commandant of the drug unit of the Spanish police in Madrid. I was talking to him only 2 days ago about narco subs coming into the Spanish coast. How now that the price of cocaine is so low that the drug smugglers are reusing the subs rather than dumping them out in the Atlantic. Also, Derek Maltz. Derek was acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration. But during the series, we've got two resident guests, Phil Matthews and also Graham Honey. They've been colleagues for 40 years. They're both senior investigators, but they're also both drug liaison officers. UK Customs and Excise, in the late 70s and into the 80s, created an international intelligence network, placing their own staff in countries around the world. Phil and I have known each other for a long time, but Phil, could you just tell me how long you were in customs, the sort of posts that you held and the jobs you did?
Yeah, I'm a career law enforcement officer. Spent over 38 years in law enforcement in UK, working for Customs and Excise, working for the National Criminal Intelligence Service, and then latterly the Serious Organised Crime Agency, / National Crime Agency. I was lucky enough to do 3 years in Thailand as the drug liaison officer out there, looking after our interests in Southeast Asia, and followed by a couple of years in the management side, looking after our liaison officers with Graham in North America, Caribbean, South America. I then went to Washington for 5 years as the senior drugs and crime liaison officer, looking after global deconfliction between UK agencies and the American agencies, high-value targets around the world.
You've been in operations, I know, up on the Burmese border against the drug gangs, down in South America as well. Lots of war stories. Any particular memories that come back to you from those days?
Too many, Lynn. Not all great ones. But one of the good things of working both on the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere is I got a really good grounding in both the heroin business and the cocaine business from source to street. I've been lucky enough to look at, visit drug production in South America, in Colombia and many other countries down there. I've been to heroin labs in the Golden Triangle. I've also worked in Afghanistan, Iran and many other countries around the world.
And the man who came to shoot you when you were in the embassy?
Wasn't my greatest day, but at least we dealt with him.
And using Mrs. Matthews as an undercover agent.
Yes, that wasn't a good day at the office either. I thought it was a good idea at the time, but we'll explain that further down the road.
Graham, too, welcome to Narco Warriors. As I said, the two of you have known each other for a very, very long time. You joined at a similar time.
Firstly, I'd just like to correct you, Lindsay. Phil was the senior one because he was far brighter than I ever was. Some people say the only reason he went up the ranks is because he snivelled to everybody, but I wish to dispel that rumour. It was on pure ability. I joined Customs in 1975, having come down from a small village in Scotland. My first posting was to be a dreaded VAT inspector at Southall VAT office. I quickly realised that this wasn't my forte and quickly managed to escape to become an investigator. I joined the investigation division in 1977. I quickly realised that I wanted to become a narco warrior, go into drugs.
The glamorous part of your job becomes when you head off to Miami in the Caribbean. First week on the job in Barbados, it should have been a routine operation. You find yourself in a gunfight.
That's right, and we'll cover this in detail in a subsequent episode. But it was a real baptism of fire. It's very topical to what was happening currently with Venezuela.
Yeah, I very much want to get all of your views on that. Well, also, I'm really pleased to have with us Peter Walsh. Peter is an author, he's a journalist, and also a publisher. Peter spent actually 6 years writing a book called Drug War. And Drug War is the definitive account, really, of the history of Customs and Excise Investigation Branch and Investigation Division and how it expanded into becoming a drug liaison network worldwide. Peter, welcome to Narco Warriors, and thank you for the help you've given us. When you started researching the book, had you ever heard of the Customs and Excise Investigation Division?
I had no idea on a national level of what they did, how big the division was, how it was structured, what kind of areas it specialised in, the specialist teams that it had for different drug groups. Actually, very few people had really bothered to find out what this extremely effective, extremely active organisation actually did. A lot of it was certainly new to me for the first time, but what surprised me even more was it was new to pretty much everybody. There was almost nothing written. There was no connecting of the dots to see how this all fit into this rather secretive, rather, I mean, I think viewed it by itself as an elite organisation.
Well, Narco Warriors is certainly looking at the historical story of UK Customs and Excise and the Investigation Division, but we're very much a contemporary podcast. We want to find out what's going on now down in Venezuela after strikes by missiles on drug-carrying boats and, of course, the arrest of the President Maduro by American forces. Really pleased to say that talking to us from Venezuela is Graham Dick. Graham is a veteran of HM Customs and Excise. Between 1996 and 1999, he served as the UK's drug liaison officer at the British Embassy in Caracas, overseeing intelligence across Venezuela and the Caribbean. Graham later returned to Caracas to co-found and train an elite vetted unit within the Venezuelan National Guard, which was a groundbreaking initiative at the time. Graham now lives in Venezuela. Graham, what was it like the morning after Maduro was lifted? What was the atmosphere like in the country?
Well, let me go back a couple of hours. I was sound asleep, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard what I thought was thunder. So I went to the window to see how heavy the rain was, and it was a nice, clear, cloudless sky. And I thought, hang on. And then within a few seconds, there was a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth. And they were all missiles targeting the military base, the airstrip in the middle of Caracas, which is less than a kilometer from where I live. And about 5 o'clock, I went to bed, woke up at seven to about 55 different messages saying, are you still alive?
Was there dancing in the streets that Maduro was no longer president?
There was dancing in the houses. There was no open display of yippee, he's gone. Nothing like that. His military mechanism, his repression mechanism is all still here. We all delete our text messages every 2 or 3 days. We delete any videos, any funny videos that we have. We delete any comments of happiness or, you know, he got what he deserved. Everyone's doing that because they're still picking up people and they're still having checkpoints and they're still checking people's phones. And that's not going to stop.
What's the situation in Venezuela when it comes to the drug trade? Because ostensibly this was all about attacking and capturing narco-terrorists. Has any of this action by the US stopped or hindered the drug trade at all?
Yes, it has. There's not a shadow of a doubt. They're not getting out now, not as much as they used to, because they just think they're going to get blown up. They're also not even going out to go fishing, which is the main lifeline.
The other thing, Graham, I'd be interested in on your view on is that in the UK press and wider European press, we've had, understandably, a lot of coverage of the president being extradited forcibly back to the States and his wife. What we haven't heard about is the other people who've been indicted with him, which have been the Minister of the Interior, the Chief Justice, people from the military intelligence of Venezuela, from the other armed forces, from the Guardia Nacional, from other police forces. There's a number of them there, but you also include two senior FARC members. For me, this smells exactly why the Americans have designated it as a foreign terrorist organisation. These people were running the country in Venezuela. They're all on the same indictment for drug trafficking, corruption, etc. It seems to me that the DEA have done a bloody good job here in getting rid of a regime that was corrupt.
Yeah, well, they've taken the head of the Hydra. They couldn't really go after everyone at the same time because it would have been chaos and Americans would have died. So they've done a very, very, very surgical operation, which was quite honestly magnificent.
Graham, you spent a lot of your career, of course, gathering evidence, putting cases together to put it before a judge and jury. When these attacks on these drug boats first started, and they seemed to be basically, we think it's a drug boat, we're sending a missile, we're going to kill all of them. Did that not bother you as an investigator that due process wasn't being followed?
It disgusted me. It absolutely disgusted me. We brought up to gather intelligence, to take out the drugs, interdict the drugs, arrest the bad guys, but then try and work up the line, try and find out who the suppliers were, try and find out where the storage was, try and dismantle the whole link from A to Z. I think it's just assassination. And particularly when you blow up one boat and there's two survivors and you go out and back and kill the survivors.
Yet at the same time, with your other comments, it's damaged an illegal trade, which causes all sorts of harm in countries around the world.
Yes, I would accept that 100%. It's certainly done some damage, but it won't stop it. They'll find new ways. They'll find new routes. They always do.
When we were in Barbados, we discussed ad nauseum about what legal actions we could take against these pirogues coming up from there. The majority all went to the Eastern Caribbean. They went into Grenada, St. Vincent, St. Lucia, Dominica. We hardly saw any going into Antigua, which is the furthest north of the Antilles. And there was no way, and I stress this, there was no way any of it was going directly to the United States of America. These vessels could not make that journey. They did not have the fuel to do it.
I've got Peter Walsh with us. Peter, I just wonder, listening to Graham's comments, you've got some firm views about what's happening in the Caribbean and Venezuela yourself, haven't you?
I agree with what Graham has just said about the morality and the legality of the strikes authorised by the Americans. The latest figure that I had as of a couple of days ago was 126 people have been killed so far in these supposedly targeted strikes. And the justification the Americans administration has produced for this is the claim that these people were engaged in what they call a non-international armed conflict, and that they are designated terrorist organisations. The problem with this claim is that most, I think, legal experts who know this area say that the strikes are actually illegal, extrajudicial killings. The military is not allowed to target civilians, even suspected criminals, unless they pose an imminent threat of violence, which is clearly not the case here. There's no due process. In fact, as far as I can see, there's no process at all. There are no drugs seized. There's no evidence. If there even was any evidence, it's at the bottom of the sea. I think these are serious criminal acts. And I do hope that one day the people responsible are called to account for it.
Peter, I entirely agree with you. They spoke to the families and identified some of the families of the people that were killed. Now, the only way that they know that they're killed is that basically they've disappeared. One was a taxi driver in the village. One was a retired policeman. One was a little criminal who, you know, occasionally was offered $1,000 to take 20 kilos of cocaine to Trinidad or Grenada. This was not international narco-terrorism.
Just for our listeners, could you just describe what role does Venezuela play today in the transportation of drugs from South America to the rest of the world?
It's a transit country, pure and simple. There's no production. Production is down in Peru and Bolivia, as we know. There are very few laboratories, although there are some on the western side of the country along the border with Colombia, but very few. It's a transit hub. And in the early days when Graham and Phil and myself and everyone worked here, it was yacht traffic. With Operation Journey, it was pirogues going out to freighters, which would then go across the Atlantic. Very rarely would they go to the States. Latterly, a few years ago, it started being planes going into West Africa and then coming into Europe via Morocco and places like that. It's always been transit. And in fact, if you look at the indictment against Maduro, you will see that they only mentioned two consignments of drugs. One went to Paris and one went to Mexico.
Thanks, Graham. I'm just going to ask your two old colleagues a question about what they did with pirogues and fast boats back in the day.
As I say, 25 years ago, it was no different. And we took a judicial approach to this. And what we were considering was, how can we take these things out? What we were working with the military was, could they shoot these pirogues but shoot the engines? And that's what we were able to achieve. We had several successes where the military would be in a helicopter, would then shoot at the engine of the pirogue, and it would stop it. We then would then try and send assets to recover the vessel to make sure, A, there were drugs there. However, where our problems then started coming is the bad guys got wise to this, and the junior member of the crew, his task was to lie on the engine. And the minute they lay on the engine, we couldn't fire at it. As much as you think you would want to, we just couldn't do that. It just wasn't legally justified. We tried to wait till they came into judicial waters, and then the local police, local Coast Guard would take action against them. And quite often it would end in a firefight, but that's because the bad guys opened fire first. So it was always justified.
I did my first trip to Venezuela in 1994, and we had some good cooperation, some effective cooperation with some people. But even at that time, there was corruption and senior corruption. I think if you look at it from an American perspective, the DEA ran out of steam in about 2005 and cut off relationships with all the Venezuelan police agencies. They were increasingly frustrated about lack of cooperation, lack of collaboration and getting things done. And that remains the same till today. Just as an insight, to try and improve relations, in a year later, we brought the head of the national police in Venezuela and the head of the judicial police in Venezuela to London and gave them a week visiting various law enforcement agencies. And on my first day in the office with the two generals, they said to me, "Well, we've got a question for you, Phil. Why do you run informants in the black?" And by that, I mean that we didn't tell the Venezuelan authorities the details of our informants in Venezuela. And I think they expected me to be a bit defensive. But in fact, having spoken to the guys down in Venezuela, we decided we'd go on the front foot. And I said, well, it's quite easy, General. You two don't trust each other. Your agencies don't talk to each other. Your agencies do not collaborate, do not share information. And in fact, you dislike each other.
And how did that go down?
It went down like a lead balloon, but the reality check came in because it was absolutely true. And I said, that's why we don't give you our informant details.
I spoke yesterday to a man called James Gagliano. James was an FBI officer. He also worked on their hostage team and was an undercover agent. Like all of you, was a serving investigative officer. And I've asked him just give us the American perspective on what American law enforcement thinks about what's going on down in the Caribbean and Venezuela. James, welcome to Narco Warriors. What about your own contacts who are still in place in service in the Caribbean, whether in the military or in law enforcement? Have you had any feedback from them about whether they think this is a good policy, whether it's an illegal policy, whether it's having an early effect on the drug trade coming through or the drugs coming through from South America?
I think that the people that I've talked to are representative of the United States. We have, what, 340 million people here? And every time we have a presidential election, half the country votes one way, half the country votes the other way. And I think it's probably evenly divided. I think there are some of my colleagues that feel that this is awful, wrong, and it should be stopped, that Congress should act and the president should not be doing this without a formal declaration of war. I think there are others that say it's about time. Send a message, do this. And again, it's a deterrent effect. It's not about stopping that one boat that's loaded with kilos of cocaine. It's about that deterrent effect.
But does it bother you, therefore, that there isn't due process when a missile hits one of these boats at the moment?
I think from my perspective, the way that I would look at this is the classification. Yes, there's always the notion that selling drugs or distributing drugs is not a capital offense in the United States. It is in some parts of this world, but it's not in the United States. So if that's what our argument is that, you know, everybody's entitled to due process, then how is that due process? You're basically taking these people out, being, as you pointed out, judge, jury, executioner. Then you step to the other side and you say, yes. However, just a couple of years ago, 200,000 people in this country overdosed on fentanyl and died. And yes, the Venezuelan drug smugglers, it's not all fentanyl that they're moving. They're mostly moving cocaine. But if you look at the overdose deaths in the United States, and you could probably push back on me and say, well, you see, your country has an insatiable appetite for drugs. Maybe that's the problem instead of the countries that are selling this and pushing this to you. Well, it's, again, the classification of, are you going to look at these as terror organizations because it's resulting in the death and destruction in America? Or are you looking at them as business owners that are conducting an illegal business? And I think that's where it gets into the legal argument. And I can see it both ways.
Graham in Caracas, I suppose what James is really saying there is the ends justify the means, but you wouldn't take that point of view.
I know what he says. A lot of my friends down here are quite happy to see these boats go up in flames. A lot of them are very happy. And then again, there's a lot of people who are very, very uneasy. The other thing as well is if you blow one of these boats up, you're losing any opportunity to gather intelligence to find out where they came from. You know, there's no one to speak to because they're all dead. If you keep on killing them on the high seas, you don't get any intelligence.
We're also talking about two different sides of the spectrum here. Yeah. I know they're connected by drug trafficking, but what we're looking at is a failed state that has supported drug trafficking for 25 years. And with that, a whole host of institutionalized government corruption. And then we're looking at, down at the tactical end, the Americans tactically attacking the boats down there. What the Americans have done with Venezuela is what they were trying to do with Colombia in the early 90s, when Colombia was a failed state, where Escobar got elected and was nearly going to be running for vice president. When I first went down there in 93, you know, there were bombings in the streets. It was absolute carnage down there. And then got rid of Escobar and from the Medellin cartel, we went to the Cali cartel for a couple of years. And then eventually the DEA and the Colombians attacked the Cali cartel. And then you went into a load of fragmented cartels. But the country moved forward. Why did it move forward? It's because the Americans underpinned it all with Plan Colombia, improving the judiciary, capacity building from prisons to the police, to the Coast Guard, to the military, and doing a whole host of socio-economic, geopolitical, really positive things. You would hope there's a plan B for Venezuela here.
If you live in within a democracy that's governed by the rule of law, there's always a moral element to this. But this, I'd like you to listen to James Gagliano on a previous president and drone strikes, which sound very, very similar to, in a sense, what Trump has been doing in the Caribbean.
I think, you know, there, from the perspective of looking at this geopolitically, I certainly understand what this president is seeking to do. You know, he's rattled his saber a little bit about occupying Greenland. But a big part of this, I think, is this president doing this as an deterrent effect to basically put China and Russia on notice that this is the Western Hemisphere, the U.S. is still the only existing superpower, and we are going to make sure that this part of the world stays safe.
And you think that what's going on with the Venezuelan drug issue, that's all part of that as well, blowing boats out of the water with military missiles?
Well, you know, from the legal perspective, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've certainly read enough of what some of my colleagues that worked at the Department of Justice and are now retired and in private practice, but what they have written and said about it. And there are arguments to be made here. There are arguments to suggest that, well, this is a violation of international law, or these are extrajudicial killings. But the president has framed this and shaped this in a way, I think, that allows him to navigate that the same way that President Obama navigated drone strikes in countries all across the Middle East. Now, you could probably push back and say, but you're accusing people of being terrorists that are merely drug smugglers. Well, the Trump administration has reclassified many of the cartels that I'm familiar with from my time down in Mexico, and some of these violent gangs that are also narco traffickers like Tren de Aragua in Venezuela as drug trafficking organizations and essentially terrorists. I think that's the dicey legal argument. But the president's number one role since we became a nation, it's his number one or her number one role is to keep America safe. And when you look at the number of people that have been dying in droves due to fentanyl or due to overdoses from cocaine and heroin across the years, his argument is going to be, that's what I'm doing by preventing those shipments from getting here. And here's the other thing. It has a deterrent effect, because when the drug smugglers see that, they begin to worry. If he's doing that on the open seas in international water, he could do that on one of our land routes as well. And I think it does have a deterrent effect.
James is right. So it was around about 2010 under the Obama administration that they pursued in Afghanistan after 9/11, the subsequent destruction of the Taliban, they pursued a policy of eradication of the opium fields. And it hadn't really worked. It hadn't affected the heroin trade. So the Obama government adopted instead a policy where they put 50 major traffickers on a kill or capture list, wanted dead or alive. And I describe this in my book, Drug War, as the moral endgame of the war on drugs. They trained up these rather controversial DEA teams called FAST teams, who would go in with US Special Forces. And it was, as it said, kill or capture. I think it was about 2017 that the US military first bombed narcotics processing labs in Afghanistan from the air and actually killed innocent children and adults in the process. But as one US Air Force officer declared at the time, the gloves are off, which was the attitude of the US military at that time. Ironically, at the time that what you might call the war on drugs was entering its bloodiest phase, world opinion seemed to be on drugs and the legality of drugs seemed to be moving in the opposite direction.
Phil, how would you respond to the point?
I think Peter's point's absolutely right, and I agree with James as well. But in relation to the American military strikes, there's two things here. There's the strikes on designated kingpins, designated people of positions of authority in drug trafficking organisations, and there's the terrorist strikes on terrorists, designated terrorists, and everything that surrounds them. From my perspective, you know, that's not the way to do it. If you actually got a kill or capture order on a narco trafficker, and under the American legislation, that's what you've got, well, send in a sniper and take him out. But don't take out innocent people, whatever the circumstances, that is not acceptable. If you can do a surgical strike from the air, which only takes the narco trafficker out and he's on a kill or a capture order, hey, fine with me, but I'm not willing to accept the law of unintended consequences. And I'm afraid if you can't control the ground, there's always going to be innocent bystanders killed.
People will also be thinking to themselves, why should I be interested in the drug trade? Why is this conversation more important than ever after 50 years of trying to take down organised crime groups who have been moving drugs around the globe?
The answer is many and varied, Linds, but I think we all know that cocaine prices are at an all-time low. Does that reflect the lack of enforcement activity over the last few years? We can talk about that, but you have to put on the table that it's not just overdose deaths. You know, the Americans do get over 100,000 people a year die from overdoses. But look at the people who die from drug-related crime. Look at the domestic violence from drug-related crime. Look at the amount of driving while under the influence of drugs and causing accidents. Look at gang warfare, not in America, in the UK. It's fueled by drug trafficking. And if we don't get a grip of drug trafficking, it will get worse and worse and worse. And by the way, all the time, they're making money and they're reinvesting that money, often in other crimes.
This isn't a hobby to these bad guys. This is about money. I think the UK has taken its eye off the ball. The law enforcement effort since our day, I don't think, has been there. And that's not necessarily the fault of law enforcement. It's a criticism of the government taking their eye off it. Very controversially, I'll say, is it a bigger threat to the UK to have X thousand people coming in on a boat where there is a huge resources being put into it, or is it a bigger threat that we see the amounts of cocaine, the amounts of heroin coming into this country and the destruction it's causing to our society? I don't know what the answer is, but I think what's happened is the balance has gone too much against some of the threats and taken away from what is a genuine threat, which is drugs.
Peter, you've studied this whole story and you know many of these investigators. If you look back from your perspective over 50 years of the drug war, what's the scorecard?
Graham's absolutely right about the money. So if you look at, for example, the importance of cryptocurrency now in the entire world economy, a huge proportion of the cryptocurrency will be drug money. And quite famously, a senior member of the United Nations said after the financial crash of 2007-2008, that it was only drug money that kept the entire world economy afloat, because that was the only liquidity that was coming into the system at all. So that tells you...
That's an extraordinary statement.
Extraordinary statement, yeah. And it shows you how huge these flows of money are, and then you think, well, what that can lead to, such as wide-scale corruption of governments, which we've seen in South America. But let's not kid ourselves that it's confined to what were formerly third world countries. We might be at another turning point in the so-called war on drugs. The first turning point, if you like, was 1961 with the single convention of in the United Nations, which meant that every country who was in the UN committed themselves to prohibiting drugs and to pursuing them. In March last year, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs had what was its 68th session, and the member states passed a resolution calling for an independent panel to review the implementation of this international control regime. The implication is that there is going to be, or it's going to recommend, some kind of liberalisation of the drug regime, which we're already seeing right across the world. Countries from Portugal, Spain, Germany, South Africa, quite a large number of states in the US that have legalised or decriminalised cannabis. So it may be that in the next 2 or 3 years, we do see a complete rethink of the regime we've had in place since 1961, which is those drugs are illegal, those people who smuggle them should be prosecuted, those people who buy them should be prosecuted, those people who use them should be prosecuted, to some different kind of regime.
Well, we want you listening as well. We want your opinions on all of this, and you can email us at intel@narcowarriors.com, because we very much want your feedback. There may have been things on the show that you heartily agree with. There may be things you've heard on this particular episode that you violently disagree with, but we would like to hear your opinions and your questions too to our expert guests. I'd like to look at the show going forward, Phil and Graham, and just go through some of the topics that we're going to be talking about in subsequent episodes. We're talking about gunfights on beaches. Phil, you're going to be in the poppy fields of Thailand.
Yeah, but I'd also like to say, Linds, if some of the audience violently disagree with what we're saying, I don't care.
You'll have to argue your case, though. I'm sorry. Also, you went shopping in Tehran once at a time when most Westerners were being kidnapped. We're going to tell that story further down the line. A pal of yours, Alan Pamplin, now living in Panama, the day that Fidel Castro turned up on a UK customs operation. A man called Jim Jarvie, another great storyteller and investigator, will be telling us about DiCarlo, the mafia strangler living in Woking, who we arrested many, many years ago, and may or may not have killed or murdered a man called Roberto Calvi, found hanging under Blackfriars Bridge many years ago. We're also looking at the Costa del crime. This was a time, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, when villains from all over Europe, but especially the UK, could escape the attentions of police forces because there was no extradition treaty down there. And we're also going to be looking at the tragic murder of a colleague of Graham and Phil's called Peter Bennett on an operation in South London in the 1970s. Thank you very much for listening, and also thank you to our guests in our podcast studio today. Also, Graham Dick down in Venezuela and James Cagliano over in the States. You can find Narco Warriors on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. The website is narcowarriors.com, and you can contact us with questions and comments on intel@narcowarriors.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, X, and TikTok, and new episodes will drop every Monday morning at 6 a.m. GMT. But before we go, some sad news. A very close friend of Graham and Phil, Dave Cook, passed away this week, and we'd like to pay tribute to the extraordinary contribution he made to UK customs and excise over his entire career, which goes way back to the 1970s. Phil, do you want to say a few words about Dave?
Dave was one of our first DLOs in Colombia, and he did a 5-year stint down there and did some extraordinary work on drug law enforcement. He then came back and went to GCHQ, where he spent over 12 years, did a fantastic job there. Dave had a formidable career in drug law enforcement, and we're all going to miss him.
Dave was a special person. He's one of several that we've lost over the years, and many of them will feature in episodes that we've got coming up. But again, it's our thoughts are with his family at this time.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. In our next episode, the drug scene began in the 60s with hippies and cannabis, but it soon grew into a multinational business, smuggling cocaine, heroin, and synthetic drugs around the world. But how to fight back? In the United Kingdom, Customs and Excise built a formidable team of investigators, working with, but independent from the police, to blunt the narcotic trade. Also ahead, the investigator becomes the target.
The spooks had told us at the embassy, this isn't just a warning, this is a real threat.
And how not to sample a cocaine stash.
If you want to die, go ahead and do that, because you don't know what's in there.
These are the Narco Warriors. Join us again soon.